After weeks of intense lobbying, Al Gore cast a tie-breaking vote in the Senate to pass our budget. It had also passed the House by only one vote, and not a single Republican in either chamber voted for it. I signed the legislation on August the 10th. It reversed 12 years in which the national debt had quadrupled, with deficits built on overly optimistic revenue numbers and an almost theological belief that low taxes and high levels of spending would somehow bring enough growth to balance the budget. At the ceremony, I specifically acknowledged those senators and representatives whose support never wavered from beginning to end, and who therefore were never mentioned in the news stories. Every yes voter in both houses of the Congress could rightfully say that but for him or her, we would not be here today. Predictably, the Republicans said my economic plan would cause the sky to fall, calling it a job killer and a one-way ticket to recession. They were wrong. Our bond market gambit would work beyond our wildest dreams, bringing lower interest rates, a soaring stock market, and a booming economy. The wealthiest Americans would get their tax money back and more in investment income. The middle class would get their gas tax money back many times over, and lower home mortgage rates, lower interest costs for car payments, student loans, and credit card purchases. Working families with modest incomes benefited from the earned income tax credit right away. We had brought arithmetic back to the budget and broken America of a bad habit. Unfortunately, though the benefits began to accrue right away, the people wouldn't feel them for some time. In the meantime, my fellow Democrats and I bore the brunt of the public's withdrawal pains. I couldn't expect gratitude. Even with an abscessed tooth, nobody likes to go to the dentist. On September 9th, Itzhak Rabin called to tell me that Israel and the PLO had reached a peace agreement. It was achieved in secret talks the parties held in Oslo, which we were informed of shortly before I took office. On September 10th, I announced that the Israeli and Palestinian leaders would sign the agreement on the South Lawn of the White House on Monday the 13th. The agreement would be signed by Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Mahmoud Abbas, better known as Abu Mazen, both of whom had been intimately involved in the Oslo negotiations. On the morning of the 13th, the atmosphere around the White House was alive with excitement as well as tension. We had invited more than 2,500 people to the event. There was a question of whether Rabin and Arafat would shake hands. I knew Arafat wanted to do it. Before arriving in Washington, Rabin had said he would do the handshake if it will be needed, but I could tell he didn't want to. When he arrived at the White House, I raised the subject. I told Itzhak that if he was really committed to peace, he'd have to shake Arafat's hand to prove it. The whole world will be watching, and the handshake is what they'll be looking for. Rabin sighed and said, I suppose one does not make peace with one's friends. Then you'll do it, I asked. He almost snapped at me. All right, but no kissing. The traditional Arab greeting was a kiss on the cheek, and he wanted no part of that. We had decided that I would shake hands with each of them first, then sort of motion them together. I was sure that if Arafat didn't kiss me, he wouldn't try kissing Rabin. Just before the ceremony, all three delegations gathered in the White House. Everyone else walked out on cue, leaving Arafat, Rabin, and me alone for a moment. Rabin said, You know, we're going to have to work very hard to make this work. Arafat replied, I know, and I'm prepared to do my part. We walked out into the bright sunshine of a late summer day. I opened the ceremony with a brief welcome and words of thanks, support, and encouragement for the leaders and their determination to achieve a peace of the brave. Peres and Abbas followed me with brief speeches, then sat down to sign the agreement. Secretary of State Warren Christopher and Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozarev witnessed it, while Rabin, Arafat, and I stood behind and to the right. When the signing was completed, all eyes shifted to the leaders. Arafat stood on my left and Rabin to my right. I shook hands with Arafat and then turned and shook hands with Rabin, after which I stepped back out of the space between them and spread my arms to bring them together. Arafat lifted his hand toward a still reluctant Rabin. When Rabin extended his hand, the crowd let out an audible gasp, followed by thunderous applause as they completed the kissless handshake. All the world was cheering, except for diehard protesters in the Middle East who were inciting violence and demonstrators in front of the White House claiming we were endangering Israel's security. I closed the ceremony by bidding the descendants of Isaac and Ishmael, both children of Abraham, Shalom, Salam, peace, and urging them to go as peacemakers. We had little time to savor our victory in the Middle East. That night, Presidents Bush, Carter, and Ford had dinner in the White House to celebrate the peace signing, And the next day, they all joined me to kick off the campaign to pass the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. In a televised address on health care reform to a joint session of Congress on September 22nd, I explained the problem as simply and directly as I could, that our system cost too much and covered too few, and outlined the basic principles of our plan: security, simplicity, savings, choice, quality, and responsibility. Everyone would have coverage through private insurers that would not be lost when there was an illness or a job change. There would be far less paperwork because of a uniform minimum benefit package. We would reap large savings through lower administrative costs, which were then significantly higher than those of other wealthy nations, and through a crackdown on fraud and abuse. According to former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop, that could save tens of billions of dollars. If the system I proposed had been adopted, it would have reduced inflation and health care costs, spread the burden of paying for health care more fairly, and provided health security to millions of Americans who didn't have it. And it would have put an end to the kinds of horrible injustices I had personally encountered, like the case of a woman who had to give up a $50,000 a year job which supported her six children because her youngest child was so ill she couldn't keep her health insurance. And the only way for the mother to get health care for the child was to go on welfare and sign up for Medicaid. I thought America could do better than that. In late October, Hillary and I personally delivered our health care legislation to Congress. Our critics had a field day with the bill's length, 1,342 pages. But every year Congress passes bills more than 1,000 pages long, dealing with less profound and complex subjects. Moreover, our bill would have eliminated far more pages of laws and regulations than it proposed to add. Everyone in Washington knew that, but the American people didn't. The bill's length gave credibility to the effective ads the health insurance companies were already running against the plan. They featured two actors as a normal-looking couple named Harry and Louise, who talked wearily about their fears that the government was going to, quote, force us to pick from a few health plans designed by government bureaucrats. The ads were completely misleading, but clever and widely seen. In fact, the bureaucratic costs imposed by the insurance companies were a big reason Americans paid more for health care, but still didn't have the universal coverage that citizens in every other prosperous nation took for granted. The insurance companies wanted to keep the profits of an inefficient and unfair system. Tapping into the well-known skepticism of Americans about any major government action was the best way to do it. Our first Christmas in the White House was especially important to me because I knew it would almost certainly be our last one with Mother, who was losing her battle to cancer. We persuaded her and Dick Kelly, her fourth husband, to come spend a week with us, which she agreed to do when I promised I'd take her home in time to get ready to go to Las Vegas for Barbara Streisand's much-heralded New Year's Eve concert. She loved Barbara, and in her mind, Las Vegas was the closest thing she'd seen to heaven on earth. I didn't know what she'd do if it turned out there was no gambling or fancy entertainment in the afterlife. While we were enjoying Christmas, Whitewater reared its head again. On December 18th, our lawyer David Kendall told us that the American Spectator, a right-wing monthly magazine, was about to publish an article by David Brock, in which Arkansas State troopers claimed they had procured women for me when I was governor. Two of the troopers agreed to be interviewed on CNN. There were some allegations in the story that could be easily disproved, and the two troopers had credibility problems of their own, unrelated to their allegations against me. They'd been investigated for insurance fraud involving a state vehicle they wrecked in 1990. David Brock later apologized to Hillary and me for the story. If you want to know more, read his brave memoir, Blinded by the Right, in which Brock reveals the extraordinary efforts made to discredit me by wealthy right-wingers with ties to Newt Gingrich and some adversaries of mine in Arkansas. Brock acknowledges that he allowed himself to be used in the smear by people who didn't care whether the damaging information they paid for was true or not. The year 1994 was one of the hardest of my life, one in which important successes in foreign and domestic policy were overshadowed by the demise of health care reform and an obsession with bogus scandal. It began with personal heartbreak and ended in political disaster. On the night of January 5th, Mother called me at the White House. She had just returned from her trip to Las Vegas. I told her I'd been calling her hotel room for several days and never found her in. She laughed and said she'd been out day and night having the time of her life in her favorite city, and she didn't have time to sit around waiting for the phone to ring. She had loved Barbara Streisand's concert and was especially pleased that Barbara had introduced her and dedicated a song to her. Mother was in high spirits and seemed strong. She just wanted to check in and tell me she loved me. It wasn't much different from the countless calls we'd shared over the years, usually on Sunday nights.